Good afternoon, everybody, or I should say good evening for some of you in on the East Coast and other parts of the world. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore, and we're here with another of our virtual events. And today we have S.A. Lelchuk with his brand new book, One Got Away. And we just got in our autographed copies right here. And there we go. For those of you who would like to order one, I'll go ahead and put it in the comments feed, the comments box on Facebook. And speaking of, I will be largely invisible, but I will be monitoring the comments. So if you have questions for Mr. Lelchuk, go ahead and put them in the comments field, and I will materialize towards the end of the program to ask any of your questions. And in the meantime, Barbara Peters is hanging by from her home office, and I'll hand it over to you, Barbara.
Thank you very much, Patrick. It's really a pleasure to see you again. I'm going to call you Saul because SA doesn't come trippingly from the tongue. We had the pleasure of welcoming you in person for your first book, Save Me from Dangerous Men, which we absolutely loved. It was one of our first mystery books of the month. The year, when was it, 2019 or 2018?
March 2019.
2019. It seems like a long time. It's taken you 2 years to write this new book, right?
This one took a little bit. Hopefully it's worth it.
Oh, well, wasn't a complaint. I was just kind of, you know, spacing it out. Anyway, oh, yeah. Save Me from Dangerous Men introduced us to Nikki. And Nikki is a truly fabulous character. I love her. She owns a bookstore, and it's cover for her more, for her darker role in which she, well, let's let Mr. Lelchuk tell you who Nikki Griffin, go ahead.
Sure, thanks. And also, Barbara, it's just wonderful to be back here. Although I missed the in-person experience, it's great to see you again and to be part of the Poison Pen. So thanks very much for having me. So Nikki Griffin, she has two jobs, essentially. She's a bookseller by day, and she loves that. And she loves the experience of that community. And she loves being able to have someone walk into the store needing something, sometimes knowing what they're looking for, oftentimes not, and being able to walk them through the shelves and make recommendations, maybe introduce them to names and authors that they have not thought of or known about, and hopefully finding them a book or two to take them on their way for whatever path that is. Some people, however, might walk into the store needing something that even a book couldn't solve, and that's where Nikki would bring them up to her office above the bookstore, a small, shabby room, not much to look at, dying house plants, you know, that kind of thing. But what when they get up there, it turns out that Nikki has another role, and that is PI and vigilante. And she will take on jobs or sometimes offer jobs to help people out of situations that even books cannot get them out of. And for Nikki, she really sees herself, you know, she has this duality to her, but she sees very much both of these halves making her who she is. The books are a real thing for her. And I think she might be a much darker character without the presence of literature in her life. At the same time, she's a rather fierce protector, especially of the defenseless. And whether it's a woman in an abusive relationship or a child or someone defenseless being attacked or maligned by a power that they cannot fight off or control. And that's where Nikki might come to the rescue and save them. And so that's the character in a nutshell.
She's a wonderful character. I love the way she rides her motorcycle around San Francisco. When I lived in San Francisco, I had a Mercedes 190 SL, which regrettably had a stick shift. And learning to park in San Francisco, curbing your wheels, trying to keep everything together with the clutch and the pedal, like this at a red light. I mean, it was exhausting. So I really understand why she doesn't want to drive, why she'd rather roar around on two wheels, because it's a real challenge to drive in San Francisco.
I think that from what I hear, flying fighter planes is tough, but I would probably pick that over driving a stick shift around in San Francisco. That is a perhaps greater challenge.
It really was. I know I was young and strong and, you know, brave at that point. But actually, the scariest part, and then I'll stop digressing here, the scariest part was parking. Because if you forgot to curb your wheels or whatever, you could come back and your car would have been long gone down Telegraph Hill or something. So it wasn't just presence of mind while driving, but it was presence of mind while you were pulling over to the curb. You know, so cable cars were a great solution to that in the places that one where they ran. And also San Francisco is a good walking city.
I try to walk it whenever I can. I do my best to not end up in a vehicle there. And some of those streets, yeah, they are mountainous, to put it mildly. They do not seem designed for four wheels.
No, well, it wasn't built with that in mind. But Nikki's over in the other side of the bay. So Nikki's over in the Berkeley area, which, you know, has really been, because of the University of California and whatever, a haven for all kinds of bookstores for forever, both new bookstores, used bookstores, and so forth. So what's the name of Nikki's bookstore?
The Brimstone Magpie. So that's a name that I always, it's stuck in my head ever since the first time I read Bleak House by Dickens. One of the characters, Grandfather Smallweed, uses that as one of his many imaginative swear words and profanities. And I always thought, I have to do something with this name. I just have to figure out what it is. And in a different life, maybe I'm running a bar or bookshop myself called the Brimstone Magpie. Instead, I worked it into the books. But Nikki said the very first book that she sells, back before she even fully knew that she was going to open a bookstore and simply was storing her books on Telegraph Avenue. And someone walks in and asks to buy a copy of Bleak House, and the rest, as they say, is history. The Brimstone Magpie.
I love it. I mean, it is so British. You know, you could be a pub. It actually does sound more like a British pub than it actually sounds like a bookstore. Because they like to get animals, you know, into the mix, so they can also paint those pub signs with, you know, a great portrait of. Does she have a sign outside that's painted with a magpie?
She does. So it's funny you mentioned that. In the very end of the second book, One Got Away, she talks about having hired a painter to etch a Victorian magpie into the glass on the bookstore. So I leave book number two with a very clear Brimstone Magpie for people to observe as they walk past.
I love it. There's a wonderful scene. I mean, there's a fair amount of violence and other interesting stuff that happens in One Got Away. But there's also a lovely scene where Nikki is talking to a child in the bookstore. And I wondered, were the two books that the child ends up going away with favorites of yours?
They were, absolutely. And you know, those scenes, it's funny, but they take me a while to write because there's so many books in my mind jostling for attention. And as a child, you know, there's so many, I don't think, for me personally, it's hard to imagine any book having the impact that some of those childhood favorites had for me. I mean, they stick in the mind and they fascinate at the time and, you know, just like nothing else. And so for me, whenever I write a scene where someone's looking for a book, especially if they're younger, there's so many possibilities that it actually takes quite a bit of time to figure out what title is going to end up in this particular scene. And I try to, you know, think, who is Nikki? And of course, you know, who is the child? And maybe even, what is Nikki's mood? Or, you know, what could I be saying about, you know, her memories relating to this specific title? But it's fun. It takes a while. There's just so many amazing ones out there.
Well, there really are. And you're right. Childhood reading experiences. Mark, I read somewhere, and it's probably true, that the music we hear, was it junior high school? I'm trying to remember. I think it might be junior. Anyway, is the music we hear all the rest of our lives. And, you know, it sticks in our heads. And that's certainly true for me. I can still do, you know, On Blueberry Hill at Chubby Checker, which is a big hit in the 1950s. But, you know, I was in junior high in the early 50s. And it really does. It's hard to update that. And I think the books you read when you're young have a magical effect that, I mean, I grew up on the Oz books, for example. They seem old fashioned today, but that was my annual birthday and Christmas treat, was a new Oz book, which I read at an age so young, I had to keep asking my parents for vocabulary help. I must have been an absolute pain in the ass. You know? Mom, what does this word mean? At least I tried. And you know, even in college, I took a course in fantasy and science fiction. I can remember reading The Once and Future King and reading Tolkien and, you know, I was a little bit older, I think, than maybe a lot of people when they read those books, but they really prompt your imagination and, you know, enrich your whole life. So I think it's great that Nikki has time, you know, to talk to children and talk to people and sell books. But the point of this book, in fact, is the mission that she's on. And the mission is one brought to her by, what's his name, Martin Johansson?
Martin Johansson, yes.
Okay. So what does Martin Johansson bring to the table?
So he is one of several siblings of a very wealthy, prominent, and yet somewhat reclusive San Francisco family, the kind of family where if you looked up the word old money in a dictionary, you might see pictures of the Johansons. And they, you know, their fortune was built on pharmaceuticals. That doesn't matter that much. But in terms of the plot, Nikki's hired because a con man, very dashing, very good looking, very charismatic, named Dr. Jeffrey Tyler Coombs, with a alleged Oxford education. He has been kind of buzzing around and circling the matriarch of the family, Mary Johansson. And she's in her early 80s, and the son is worried, of course, that she is being taken advantage of, conned, maybe even worse, maybe blackmailed. And so he hires Nikki to essentially get this fellow to follow him and ultimately to get him out of town by any means necessary. Pretty early on in the book, Nikki starts to realize that she's not being given the full truth by her client. And as she goes about speaking to his siblings and to other characters that she starts to meet, and as she starts following the con man himself, she realizes that she's not getting the full story from anyone, but in fact, there might be something much more sinister at the heart of the story going on than a simple blackmail or con or anything like that. So that's the plot in a very small nutshell. But it was, you know, it was fun for me because when I was writing it, I had we had family friends where they were a similar thing happened where the father was, you know, the elderly father who very successful had a medical practice on Park Avenue, and he was conned by someone, a helper who had been hired to take care of him, and she ended up taking a large amount of money from him. And what fascinated me was not the con itself. People steal all the time. I don't think that's revelatory by any means. But what fascinated me about it was his reaction when his children said, here's what's been done to you, father, and you know we're gonna hire people and try to get it back. And he said, absolutely not, I refuse. He said that this person gave me, you know, a lot of happiness in return for whatever was taken. I'm fine. I don't need the money. I'm not out on the street or anything like that. And he kind of put his foot down. And I thought there's a fascinating human reaction, not so much the con, not so much the theft, but the reaction to it. And so that works its way into the plot. And I think that as the readers start to get to know the elderly Mrs. Johansson, they start to realize that she's a more forceful character than perhaps her children would want to give her credit for being.
Very true. She's not a person easily conned. You know, it's interesting that we're talking about this on the day that there's a lot of news coverage about the death of Bernie Madoff. And, you know, I don't believe there were any of his clients who took the position that you just mentioned. Because, you know, for most people, for nearly anybody, you know, to be conned out of money that matters to them would be a terrible thing to live through. It ruined a lot. He ruined many lives. But that's not the position. Mrs. Johansson in the book is very wealthy. So she can afford, if she chooses, she can certainly afford to lose some money. But all of that is a great setup. But what's really fun is what happens next. Without any spoilers on the plot, I would like to say that we get to go down the peninsula and we get to drive over to Monterey and Cypress Point. And these are scenes of my youth because I had a roommate at Stanford who lived in Monterey. And I spent a lot of time down there. It's beautiful. I'm trying to remember, how old is the Monterey Aquarium?
That's a great question. I was actually kayaking in its bay last week, so I should know this answer. I'm not even gonna try to throw out a number that could be egregiously incorrect. But it's an amazing place. It's an incredible institution.
Well, it really is. And I'm trying desperately to remember whether it was there all those years ago, whether it's newer. But in any case, yes, there's the bay and there's, you know, the whole Steinbeck Cannery Row thing, which is now, of course, like one of those amusement piers in the UK, you know.
Okay.
It really is, you know, a long way from its poverty stricken or, you know, working class roots for sure. But it's a gorgeous part of California, and Cypress Point is and the 7 mile drive, all of that 17 mile drive, I guess it is magnificent. Every year I watch the Pebble Beach Golf Tournament just, you know, to enjoy the scenery and recall how beautiful it is. The wind has blown the cypress trees so that, you know, they're all growing inward. They can't grow up because they're, and it's an incredibly posh place. So Nikki follows our con man down there to discover that they're both checking into this astonishingly expensive and fabulous resort. So my question to you is that real, or did you just make that up and decide you would enjoy it vicariously?
There are a couple of resorts that this is a kind of loose composite of, but there's one or two especially that I've certainly driven past. I haven't even driven up because they have a gate and they are, as in the book, rather stern about security. I hope that one day in life things will work out. I'll win a Powerbucks or some such thing, and I will be able to check in for a night or two. Or I suppose end up on an expense account the way Nikki does. That's how she sets her foot in. But there are just some astonishingly beautiful places, and it is fun for me to get to use those locations and, you know, play with them and work them into a story. I suppose in some ways to be enjoyed by people like myself who might not otherwise be enjoying them.
Well, it's not really that far from San Francisco. You come all the way down the peninsula, then you have to cut over to the coast. I once had to drive to Los Angeles and thought I would take the scenic route, Highway 1, down the coast. So we cut over. And unfortunately, when there is a landslide, as happens, right around Big Sur, you are screwed. You have to drive all the way back to, what is it, El Camino or whatever the road is, and down. I mean, so it's a slightly risky thing to head over to the coast if you're going to go south. But Nikki on her motorcycle, I mean, talk about a gorgeous ride. But it's only what, like 100, 120 miles below San Francisco. It's not, you know, it's not a big deal. She can easily zip back and forth as she happens to do.
And that's, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that, because that was something I thought a lot about location. And when I was thinking about the type of setting, you know, Monterey provided, I went through different locations in my head. I thought, you know, Santa Barbara, you know, could work, you know, very well for that kind of feel. There's a few other places, you know, along the coast. But I did want something, a quick enough drive so that Nikki could get back and forth if she has to, as she does once or twice. As far as landslides, no, I don't think anyone's getting down to Big Sur these days. There was another one this past winter, and there goes a chunk of the one right into the ocean. So that is certainly a common danger.
It is a danger, and because the mountain range is right behind it, there's no real roads through it. You know, you just don't have it. It's just Highway 1, or you go back over to the flatland on the other side, on the east side of the mountains, but there you are. And California soil is not granite, and so landslides are a frequent occurrence, but one hopes that Monterey and Carmel and all will not wash away. We can only hope. Anyway, so there's Nikki in this wonderful posh setting, and unfortunately, I don't think we should tell you what happens, but it's really cool and very surprising. And in fact, the whole book is very surprising. So What social issues, since we can't talk about the plot, I know that you really like to address some serious stuff, even though, you know, these are humorous, kick-ass, you know, all those good stuff. But what is it that you wanted to underline in this book?
Absolutely. So I think a couple of things, and some are certainly more pronounced than others. So, you know, for example, the Johannesson family themselves. I'd been reading a lot in the papers, like most of us, about the Sackler family, for example, who I think it's fair to say have done a rather extraordinary amount of harm to the country through their products, and probably to many other countries. And so, you know, I think that this is one of the kind of fascinating things about America specifically. I won't say just America, but, you know, wealth is celebrated. And the more wealth you have in many circles, the more celebrated you are. And whether you're looking at the, you know, fortunes of plantation owners or of slaughterhouses or some of the railroad tycoons, I mean, going back in history, many people with the most money were not particularly nice people, and they weren't doing the nicest things. So that was always in the back of my mind. And, you know, I don't think there's much that I could say that's going to ruffle the Sackler's feathers. But at least, you know, when I write a book, I can be kind of, you know, thinking about these things. Socioeconomics are certainly, you know, another thing that's always on my mind. In fact, I think it's pretty hard to live in California these days and, you know, not have these thoughts running through your head. And so for me, when I think about setting, I do try to kind of juxtapose in a way that shows not just, you know, a literal streetscape or landscape of where someone is, but also to kind of, you know, loosely paint a suggestion of what larger truth, you know, is out there. So for instance, the very end of the book, the second to last chapter, I think, shows Nikki, you know, riding up Market Street through this, you know, rain slashed, you know, cold night. And she's looking up at these, you know, gleaming, beautiful, you know, tech towers with these, you know, very, very, you know, well-known companies inhabiting them. And then in the doorways, you know, are crowded with homeless people, you know, sleeping there. And so I think that in those, you know, small moments and images, it's not some huge part of the book. But I do like to try to remind people that there are some issues that have not been figured out, to put it mildly, and are certainly worth being paid attention to. And again, I think you would have to have a pretty heavy, thick pair of blinders on to be unaware or indifferent to, you know, some of these things if you do live in the state or if you travel through it or anything like that. A third thing that I'd say is also just, I really kind of delight in the tradition that, you know, certainly goes back to, you know, iconic films such as, you know, Chinatown and, you know, some of the iconic characters like, you know, Marlowe and Spade and so forth. Of where they show that as bad as the, you know, seedy denizens of the, you know, late night bars and the pool halls and the cheap criminals who will, you know, stab you in the back for 10 cents, as bad as some of these people might be, they don't hold a candle to the kind of corruption that's up there on the penthouse levels. These are the people doing truly bad things with, you know, far reaching effects. And so I think that's a kind of delightful lesson when you're writing, you know, this genre, detective or crime fiction, to be able to kind of suggest that oftentimes it really does flow towards the top, and the people at the top, you know, in their expensive clothes and in their, you know, beautiful resorts and hotels and apartments, maybe they are the ones to keep a close eye on, because some of the things they're doing, although not in the front page of the papers all the time, might have a pretty far-reaching, you know, effect on the worlds that they inhabit. So these are some of the issues kind of going through my mind as I worked on this book.
Well, you're certainly living in an area, or setting it in an area of remarkable contrast. San Francisco used to be mid-20th century, a very formal city. It had old families, old history. People wore gloves when they went out. The symphony was highly dressed. It was very much like Charleston, or even maybe old Boston. And, you know, the war, the Vietnam War, really changed San Francisco in remarkable ways. All of a sudden we got Haight-Ashbury and, you know, a complete disruption of the older city. And then when Silicon Valley and all the tech, I mean, the whole peninsula from San Francisco down past Palo Alto, you go through Mountain View, you know, all the rest of it, Menlo Park, Atherton, Palo Alto, Mountain View, all that money washed in and completely overturned, you know, that new order. And it isn't just the money, but the values and the lifestyle, you know, formality went out the door. And so much of the San Francisco that I first knew, I think, is gone forever. And it has exacerbated the Gulf. This is true in Seattle too. I mean, if you go to Seattle, there's a tremendous problem. And you know, part of it is because they have benign climates. You can survive on the streets. You can't do it in Phoenix. You know, you can't be a homeless person in Phoenix in July with a great survival rate. But San Diego, Los Angeles, San Francisco, certainly Seattle, which have relatively mild year-round climates, naturally attract homeless populations. Some of them migrate. And so what do you do about that? What do you do about sanitary facilities? What do you do about healthcare and all the rest of it? And it's a wild contrast when you look at the, you know, both the old money and the new money. I don't know how it is down the peninsula. Is it your experience that there are as many homeless people and so forth in, let's say, Menlo Park? Certainly not in Atherton, because Atherton is like all estates, but going down towards Menlo Park, Redwood City, maybe Palo Alto, do you see a lot of that?
It's I don't find it comparable to what you might find in San Francisco or, you know, East Bay. You know, and when you go to, you know, if you drive around the heart of Silicon Valley, San Jose certainly has a significant homeless situation, I should say that. But if you go through some of these towns, like the ones you mentioned, or, you know, Cupertino, for example, you know, next door to Apple headquarters, it's fairly invisible. And, you know, one, I don't think would notice the same things if they were driving through it.
Interesting. Well, as I say, it's been a while since I visited. I used to have a brother-in-law who lived on a houseboat in Sausalito. So, you know,
That's a dream, right?
Yeah, you squat over the Golden Gate Bridge and yet, you know, that old fishing village, and it was an old fishing village, has also been dramatically transformed. Some of the best views of San Francisco, in fact, come from some of the restaurants in Sausalito. If you look back, and if you're lucky, the fog, it can blow in through the Golden Gate as though you were pushing whipped cream through a funnel. You know, you can be sitting there and it's this gorgeous view, and then all of a sudden it's like all this white stuff comes, you know, and why? I mean, the climate contrasts, I think, are glorious and fun to explore. And it's interesting you mentioned Chandler, because I've actually compared your new book to The Big Sleep in some respects. Unfortunately, it'll be a complete spoiler if I discuss why, but
I'm flattered at the comparison, so thank you.
I think it's a valid one. I thought about it quite seriously when I was reading it. I have to say that you really deliver surprises with this plot. I was not prepared to go where it went, which is great. I mean, you know, that's a huge amount of fun of reading it. So I didn't think The Big Sleep at the outset, but I definitely started thinking about The Big Sleep later. So what is it in Nikki's background that has made her a person whose secret, I think a quote here, her secret mission, born of revenge and trauma, is to do everything she can to get women out of dangerous situations and punish the men responsible. What happened in Nikki's life that gave her this drive?
So Nikki, up till sixth grade, was living a fairly normal life up in a little beach town, Bolinas, which, talking about changing landscapes and changing towns, Bolinas is certainly up there as well. But she was fairly normal until sixth grade, and then this terrible crime occurs to her that's done to her family, a fairly random crime, and one that kind of erases her childhood and erases her family, and puts her essentially not on the streets, but in a series of homes. And so she has a younger brother. And as she gets older, I think one of the anchors, you know, one of the real lifelines for her is taking care of him, because he is not as strong mentally, I think it would be fair to say, as Nikki. And so he starts to collapse and deteriorate, and he finds his way to all kinds of, you know, drug problems. And part of Nikki, you know, part of Nikki being able to keep herself level is knowing that her brother needs her. And I think that without her brother, then she would be really a more darker and maybe a more reckless character. I think Nikki, as she grows older, she has some strokes of good fortune. She ends up living with a foster family who are nice to her. This is after several others who are not. She finds her way to a local library, and this again is a saving force for her. And books really do allow her to kind of stabilize and to get a grip on herself. She's someone at that point, she's a teenager, and she's already struggling with issues of violence. When people say things to her, she has a hard time preventing herself from lashing out. And part of Nikki's maturation, you know, in her life from adolescence to 20s and going on, is learning how to temper and contain those urges and to start to understand that her violence, those tendencies, is not a good thing. It can be a useful thing if controlled. And so a huge part of her own life is discovering moderation and proportionality and sort of understanding that you don't react the same way with the same amount of force in every situation. And I think that discovery of modulation is a big thing for Nikki. As she gets older, I wanted to make some of her questions, you know, more universal ones. I think most people when they're in their 20s are wondering, what am I supposed to be doing here in the world? And, you know, what's my role? And like, what was I, you know, put here to accomplish? And what might I achieve? And for Nikki, these questions are going through her head the same as any others. And then she gets a job at a shelter, a domestic violence shelter. And she starts to realize that maybe this is something that she can do. And this is something she can throw herself into. She also sees the shortcomings of the shelters. And these are, you know, tragic shortcomings that I wish they were fictional, they're not, that this is not a perfect system. The legal system is far from perfect when it comes to protecting domestic violence victims. And Nikki starts to understand that there might be a role for her. And if you want to call it vigilante, you can, or anything else, but that there might be a role for her to stand independently of the law and independently of the support of the shelters and be able to protect some of these women who will not be left alone by their abusers. She starts becoming a PI essentially because she realizes that she's pretty good at it. She has skills that lend themselves to PI work. She's patient, she's methodical, she's extremely observant. She tends to be fairly soft-spoken. People oftentimes underestimate her or don't size her up in the way that they probably should be doing. And she also has a talent for violence. It's undeniable. And so these things put together create someone who's pretty good at PI work. And she certainly takes on cases that fall outside her core mission. But when it comes to someone who is defenseless and who's being hurt and is in physical danger or harm's way, she never charges for those cases. She never really questions what she's doing. She certainly doesn't hesitate to put herself in a considerable degree of danger to stop them. And that's kind of at the core of who Nikki is. It's a reflexive action. It's not something that she has full control over. It's something she's going to do just the same way that if I tap on my knee with a hammer, I'm going to kick my leg up a little bit. It's very reflexive for her.
It's interesting, you know, whether to decide whether she's a vigilante or she is really more in the tradition of the knights of old, you know, on quests where they went out to slay dragons and protect maidens and so forth. I mean, they were certainly extra legal. Well, there wasn't much in the way of a legal system anyway, but they definitely were. And one of the hallmarks of the PI genre has always been that the PI is loyal to the client, not to the system, not to the cops, whatever, but loyal to a client. And therefore they're not police procedurals. They don't have to follow that, the rules. So, you know, they can champion their clients in ways that are sometimes extra legal. But to do all this, Nikki has to be in good physical shape. This is not all mental. She's not all doing this, you know, on a keyboard. So what kind of physical preparation does she have, and what kind of physical training does she do?
That's so along with books, another thing that Nikki was introduced to by this foster family was the boxing gym. And so she started going there when she was a young teenager, a freshman in high school, and found herself pretty good at it pretty early on, and also realized that this was a sport, and I'm a boxing fan, and it certainly is a sport that not only calls for moderation of aggression, but in fact demands it. The best boxers are not the strongest. They're not the most aggressive. They're certainly not the most bloodthirsty. They're people who are able to control whatever emotions are going on and funnel them into specific physical gestures and actions. And so I thought Nikki was a good candidate for that particular sport. And it also allows her, of course, to exert a degree of force over people who get in her way, especially, as I said, because they are underestimating her. I also should say that I never wanted Nikki to come across as a kind of Terminator character. You know, I never wanted her to be the person who is a, you know, super spy who can take out, you know, 30 people, you know, in an aircraft hangar or something like that before they have time to blink and then the smoke clears and everyone's on the ground. I love some of those books and characters, but it wasn't what I wanted to do and it wasn't what I saw for Nikki. I wanted her to be able to think through her problems to apply, you know, mental calculus to physical situations. And also to understand that there's times when she's going to be able to fight her way out of of something, and there's times when she won't be. And some of the situations in this book or the first one are moments where Nikki does not get violent because she knows it would not end up well for her, that it's a situation where it's too stacked against her. So I wanted that to really come across as an element in the book, that she is a human being and she happens to be good at what she does, but she's no superhero.
Does she have weaponry available? I mean, you've talked about her physical conditioning and her boxing skills, but does she also carry any kind of weapons?
She does. She carries a gun, and she'll use it if need be in a proportional setting again. She also carries various, I suppose, tools of the trade, if you wanted to call them that. Brass knuckles, stun gun or taser, you know, all these things have found their way into her handbag at various times. And sometimes if she is going for a specific mission or objective, if there's something that she wants to be doing, she might equip herself in a certain way to get that done. And I think we see that play out in One Got Away in a couple of the scenes. I won't go into too many details, but if Nikki thinks she has to subdue someone, she might try to bring something along that would help her do that job.
Well, certainly one of her best weapons is her focus. I mean, she has a laser-like focus, and you know, if you are that intent, if you are that focused, you can do surprising things. And most people aren't. So I think they might underestimate her resolve as well as her quick responses. So she does get into a number of interesting situations in the book as it progresses. And I wish this is a book where we could talk about the end during this. We have had a couple of follow-up to these kinds of events, like a book club, where the deal is if you come, you need to have read the book because it's going to be full of spoilers. So I'm thinking about putting together sort of a serial book club where I can invite several authors and we can actually talk about how their books play out, because there's so many more things to discuss than we can actually do. So it took you an extra year to write this book, which is good. Are you working on book three? I always like to know where you're going.
Absolutely. So this one, after this book, I finished it up just as the pandemic hit last year. And right when things started shutting down, I'd had an idea for a standalone in my mind for a couple of years. And I thought, if there's ever a time to write it, it's a pandemic, because what else am I going to do? I could bake sourdough bread. I could learn origami, or I could try to do this idea. I grew up in rural New Hampshire. I grew up on a dirt road, you know, middle of the woods in an old country house dating back to the 1700s. And it was a small town. It was a town where everyone knew each other. And I always thought it would be really fun to set a book there. So the very basic premise is that a family moves into town. The husband is a musician with the Boston Symphony, and his wife is head of school at a local private school. And they move into town and buy this idyllic, beautiful country house. And then someone leaves a pie the first night on the door as a welcome present. And it turns out that there's a note attached to the pie that is quite terrifying. And then as they settle into their existence, the fellow starts to realize that strange things are happening. He starts to wonder if he's being watched. He starts to wonder if people are outside the house looking in, or perhaps even getting into the house. And he starts to wonder what they want with his family. But we also start to realize that there are cracks in his own narrative and that there's history that he's not telling us about in his own life. And so ultimately, I wanted to start to present the reader with this question. Are the problems with the town that they moved into, or are the problems with the family that moved into the town? And so that's what I spent the last year on. It was a lot of fun for me. I certainly want to come back to the Nikki books. I have ideas for certainly the third one and a couple more after that in a less fleshed out form. But it was enjoyable stepping away for a little bit and taking on a standalone, because I've lived with Nikki for years. I mean, that very literally. I literally will have conversations with her. She's in my head, which can be a delight. I think that's one of the fun parts of a series, that you get to know a character so well, because you literally do spend so much time with them, thinking about them, talking to them, asking how they might react in a certain situation. So it's kind of amazing the force that that character can start to exert on your own consciousness, you know, hour by hour.
Well, playing with imaginary friends, right? You've just extended childhood.
Exactly.
Right. So let me ask you before we call Patrick back up from the deep, what inspired you to become a writer? I mean, you know, it's obviously something you have thought about seriously, but what kind of either preparation or inspiration set you on this path?
So it was something I wanted to do from literally before I could write. I mean, literally before I knew how to write, I would dictate stories and my mother was kind enough to transpose them into paper form. I was also lucky. I grew up in a family of writers. My father, Alan Lelchuk, and my mother, Barbara Krieger, both authors. And our house, you know, when I was a kid, was oftentimes full of writers and, you know, literary conversation. And, you know, I was, you know, held by, you know, Saul Bellow as a kid. You know, he'd come be there for dinner. Philip Roth would be spending the weekend, you know, things like that. So, you know, I got an exposure that I consider myself just, you know, extremely fortunate to have had. But I always wanted to be doing it, you know, and I think that childhood exposure only takes you so far, I believe. And the urge never really wavered, you know, and as I got older, I was, you know, writing and experimenting in different forms, but it was always a preoccupation of mine. I remember I did the very classic, you know, unoriginal move of moving to New York after college, and I was, you know, waiting tables at a French bistro by night, and I was, you know, working on a manuscript during the day, and there was never anything else that I really wanted to be doing, and I always looked at my life as almost a kind of zero sum game where I felt I'm never going to be fully content and satisfied unless I get to write books. It's the only vocation that I can imagine that I would truly want to be doing forever, as close as I can get to forever at least. And so for me, that never really went away. And I was really blessed to have the character of Nikki find its way to my agency and my, you know, publisher. And, you know, I'm not looking back on that. It was, you know, it was certainly so much luck and, you know, also a lot of, I would like to say, determination.
Well, determination and perspiration are part of the writer's toolkit. It's not all inspiration by a whole lot. Patrick, let's call you up and see if there are any questions that have arisen or anything you'd like to ask Saul yourself.
Hi there. Yeah, let's see here. Well, for one thing, I wanted to ask you about this wonderful, is it epigraph? Is that the right, or epa? Yeah, a good man can be stupid and still be good, but a bad man must have brains. What a great quote.
Maxim Gorky had some gems, certainly. But yeah. That to me just seemed to kind of sum up something about the book and certainly the character of Coombs himself.
Right. I also like in here that there's a great scene where she describes what it is she actually does. And she mentions that when I'm not selling books, I try to do a little of what your crowd call philanthropy, my own special brand of the stuff. I like that too.
I'm glad you mentioned that.
There's a lot of humor in the books. You know, we've talked about all kinds of serious stuff, but one of the reasons these books are so much fun to read is they are fun.
Yeah, that scene was fun for me because there is, you know, I like Nikki has certainly a dry sense of humor, but it's, you know, it's very much there. And in that moment, you know, she's frustrated. She's angry that this wealthy family has been kind of making her jump through hoops and seemingly not fully understanding the fact that there are real lives and, you know, real people at stake here, other than themselves, of course. And so she gives that little speech to Mary Johannesson with, I think, measures of some cutting humor, but also genuine frustration at wanting this very, very wealthy person to jump down to street level and try to see it from her perspective as well.
Do you have a physical, I'm sure you do, a physical image of your character in your mind when you're writing? Or does it morph? And is it based on anybody real?
So it's not based on anyone real, Nikki isn't. And I have a loose physical image. I could certainly, you know, describe my characters, when, you know, when needed. But I generally try to think of characters a lot by, I like to define them in my mind by their actions, by their speech, by their mannerisms, certainly, you know, their habits. And so that to me goes a long way to, you know, along with physical description. You know, Martin Johannesson, when he hires Nikki in the beginning, you know, he's very kind of fastidious and he's, you know, immaculately dressed in a, you know, perfect suit and a perfectly knotted tie and so forth. But I put in a few little mannerisms to kind of show that maybe this someone is a little edgy and a little dissatisfied. And maybe there are, you know, a couple of thoughts going through his mind that he's not, you know, voicing out loud. And so I try to kind of shade in what a character looks like with a lot of the secondary description surrounding what they're doing in a given moment.
It's interesting how the reader, each reader will fill in those blanks, you know, and create something unique in their own imagination. So as far as specific questions, there is one from Debbie, and she asks, how would it have changed the plot for you if the con person had ripped, if the con person had ripped off a person who was less wealthy, where every penny is important? Would that have worked for this plot?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it kind of speaks to what Barbara was getting at earlier with, you know, mentioning Madoff, that I don't think it would have worked because it would have made his crime unforgivable in a certain way. You know, if he was someone cold-blooded enough to leave someone truly destitute, then certainly the reader is not going to want to have much forgiveness for that. And I don't think Nikki would either, you know, and part of the book, you know, and I'm not giving this away to say that a lot of the story within this is the feeling out between Nikki and Coombs and the identifying of each one in the other that there's some kind of kinship. These are two people who live outside the law, albeit in very different ways. And so this, you know, the relationship that they begin to have together and the knowledge they begin to form of each other is a real part of the story. And yeah, I think that if Coombs had done something as egregious as, you know, rendering someone, you know, insolvent or something like that, it would have been a lot harder to feel empathy for him. And empathy is something that I would hope that readers would feel a little bit for this character as they go along and realize that this very slippery, charismatic weasel of a man is not all bad. He's certainly not all good and doesn't claim to be, but bad comes in gradations in this book. There are some people who are pretty rotten to the core, and I'll leave it to the reader to find out and to determine and make the decision whether Coombs is one of them. But I think when you're writing a story and you're asking yourself, what kind of empathy am I going to feel for someone and is someone else going to feel for a character? There are certain actions that are going to render them pretty unlikable, and it's going to be pretty hard to change that, I think. So I think it would have been a very different book.
I think it would have been a very different book, too. I mean, your palette is very gray in this book, shades of gray, rather than black and white. And if somebody is truly, truly injured, truly rendered destitute or homeless or divorced or whatever it might come from, that was the tragedy of Bernie Madoff, is that he may actually ruin lives. You know, wasn't that people who could afford, many of them, the loss, not just lives, but not just people, but institutions, you know, who'd invested with him. So that kind of harm was remarkable. I was somewhat cynical about the comments in today's journal about, you know, how he lived a life of regret in prison and all. And I have some trouble buying that. You know, I didn't think he did regret it.
I agree, and he certainly didn't come clean, except you know, after the fact, there was nothing really that showed remorse up until he got caught. So I wouldn't agree with that.
Right, and you know, it was a great tragedy for his family. I mean, you know, both of his sons, one died from cancer, and the other committed suicide. I mean, it was a tragedy visited on his family, in addition to all of the victims of, you know, and. There are a lot of issues. There was terrible oversight, and you know, many people should have been suspicious earlier than they were. So there was a ton of contributing factors to the entire mess. But I don't see him as a figure who was remorseful, other than he got caught.
I would agree with that.
So anyway, Patrick, back to, we wandered off twice now.
Okay, yeah. That's a fun part of these conversations.
I know, but you know, timing's everything. It today's news does tend to factor into, you know, to discussions. And if you're going to talk for an hour and you can only talk about a book for 10 minutes, really, if, without beginning to give spoilers, it's surprising the range of topics that you end up covering. Patrick and I have been talking about that. Patrick really enjoys the way the conversations develop. And sometimes you think, Patrick, that they're different than they would be if we were with a live audience, don't you?
They often are, yeah. Yeah, and that the whole business of Madoff is really interesting because, you know, at some point, you know, either he's just an, you know, out and out sociopath, which doesn't sound like, but at some point you know, somebody like that starts to sell themselves a story that makes it okay to keep doing what they're doing, you know, and you're able to create these elaborate rationalizations for what you're doing. Fascinating. Yeah. Let's see. Okay. So Chris asks, looks like it's a she. There is such a great cast of supporting characters in One Got Away, including a precocious aspiring detective, Mason. In your opinion, what makes a good side character? Good or evil, young or old? What are some of their key attributes?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm glad that Chris enjoyed the secondary cast, as it were. I think for me, when I write side characters, it's very hard for me to see how they're going to turn out until they get some screen time. You know, and I really do use the analogy of, you know, television, where you shoot the pilot and you have all these, you know, actors and actresses in the roles. And, you know, the writer's room is deciding in sort of real time as they continue shooting the season, who of these people are kind of really breaking out and almost demanding that extra few minutes of screen time. And who maybe should be killed off early, so to speak. So right. I view fiction like that, that you write certain characters and you realize that they're only gonna give you so much, and that's fine. They can play a pretty specific, targeted, limited role, but they're not really crying out for that extra time. And then you'll write other characters. And to my mind, for example, Buster the Mechanic, you know, falls into this category. Or Ethan, Nikki's boyfriend, and you start to realize that whether it's the rapport or whether it's the, you know, strength of the character, or what they're allowing you to do in the story, but these are people who are clamoring pretty aggressively for more time on the page. And so for me, whether it's a 6'5" auto shop mechanic with a rather terrifying temper, or a very sweet little boy, who's found himself caught in a pretty unpleasant situation. A lot of it is really just trying things out, giving them their chance, giving them their kind of audition, so to speak, on the page. And then as you write the scene, starting to think, you know, how much legs does this person have, you know, and how far can I take them into the story? And I think to me, the best part about writing is you don't always get to make that decision. Sometimes they really will exert a voice in that and make that almost demand for, you know, for more time. So that can be a lot of fun because you see some people created who end up going in different directions and doing much more than you might have initially wanted to give them credit for in your own mind.
Love it. Character triage. I hadn't really thought about that, but it makes a certain amount of sense. I didn't even mention the little boy who was an absolute charmer in this book, and you'll be interested in reading about him and how he progresses. But I'm glad you brought up Ethan, because I also did not ask you whether Nikki had any kind of personal, you know, romantic relationship. And I really like Ethan a lot.
One of the first questions my publishers asked me when they had not yet officially taken the book, but they were thinking, you know, about it, and we had a conversation, and one of the questions was, is Ethan going to come back in book two? And I said, I like him, Nikki likes him, I think he is going to find his way back, and they seem quite happy with that. So I didn't want Nikki to be, there's so many stereotypes of quote-unquote tough women out there, right? They're cold-blooded, and, you know, it doesn't matter if they're, you know, in a boardroom or, you know, doing detective work or anything else, but there's so many god-awful stereotypes that are out there about if a woman is tough, then she has to suddenly trade all of her emotional sensitivity and everything else to get that toughness and hold on to it. And I, to me, when I wrote the character of Nikki, I completely wanted to go in the opposite direction. I wanted to be her to be tough, but I also wanted her to have emotional vulnerability. She sheds tears in the book sometimes. She has people where she becomes frantic out of, you know, worry about them. I mean, she has anxieties. And part of that was I wanted her, she wants, she wanted a relationship. You know, she is worried by the thought that her page-worthy tendencies might drive away any potential partner. And that's a great concern of hers, you know, from the very beginning of the first book, because she knows that she is not always the easiest partner to have given some of her reactions. And so Ethan comes along, and in the first book, he's a Berkeley grad student, you know, just earning his PhD. And in the second book, I'm happy to find them still together. And he's now got an assistant professorship at Berkeley, and he's teaching English, and he's delighted about it. And I have so much fun with their scenes. I like their rapport. I like the effect that Ethan has on Nikki. I like the fact that the relationship challenges her to open up a little bit. She's naturally fairly reclusive, maybe even a little secretive when it comes to her work, sometimes for good reason. And I really wanted this relationship to be a bit of an oyster knife there, you know, challenging her to reveal and show a bit more of herself than she might feel comfortable doing. And I think it has a pretty good effect on her. One of the very lesser subplots of the book is that Ethan feels that it's a good time for them to move in together. They've been together a year. And Nikki naturally is resistant to this because she is certainly someone who values her privacy and independence. And so I had a lot of fun playing with that because I think we've probably all been there in some fashion, making some, you know, equivalent decision. And I think that adds a level of realism to this story. You know, I didn't want every page to be Nikki running around, you know, getting the bad guys. I think that if she is struggling, and especially the quieter moments with some of these more universal decisions that I think it does add something to the character. So Ethan, to me, I wish him only the best for both of them. And I like to think that they will stick together down the road as well.
You're the only one who can do it. So, you know, we'll see how it goes. Right. Patrick, anything else?
No, that's about it for the questions.
Great. Well, it's really been a pleasure to connect with you again, Mr. Lelchuk. I love Save Me From Dangerous Men. If anybody watching this has not yet read this glorious book, which has come out now in paperback, I truly recommend it. You can certainly read One Got Away without having read it. Save Me From Dangerous Men. But since it's only book two, seems to me smart to read the first one and then read the new one. And I'm pleased to say that Mr. Lelchuk was signed our copies. Well, he signed a ton of them for Save Me From Dangerous Men, but we sold them all. And now he has definitely signed One Got Away. So don't let your copy get away. So thank you very much. We're going to make a podcast out of this. And of course, the video will live forever on our Facebook page. So do encourage your friends who might not have discovered Mr. Lelchuk or missed this event to download the podcast or watch the video. And I hope we'll see you again. Do you anticipate book three may publish next year, or is it all sort of up in the air at the moment?
A little too early to make an exact prediction, but I'm optimistic, I'm hoping.
Well, I'm optimistic too. What would April be without you? So, well, hopefully
the standalone, by the way. This is the standalone or the third book in this series?
This would be the standalone.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah, it really does. You'll fall into Jennifer McMahon territory and some other authors who've written books up in that part of the country. So it should be fascinating stuff. Anyway, it'll be a change from the Bay Area if we're going to go all the way across the country to the, you know, extreme east. It'll be fun, and show off your various talents as a writer. So good night, everybody. Thank you very much for joining us,
and thank you so much, Barbara and Patrick, for having me. It's always a pleasure, and I hope to see you and do this again in Scottsdale sometime soon.
So do we.
Great.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Hello, we hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds
will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.